You're listening to the Carnegie Tsinghua China and the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on China's foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world, brought to you from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center located in Beijing. I'm Paul Hanley, the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, and I'll be your host. Today we're joined by Chris Johnson, Senior Advisor and Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Chris spent almost two decades serving in the U.S. government's intelligence and foreign affairs communities. He worked as a senior China analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, where he played a key role in providing analytical support to policymakers during the 1996 Taiwan Strait missile crisis, the 1998 accidental bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, and the downing of a U.S. reconnaissance aircraft on Hainan Island in 2001. And the SARS epidemic in 2003. Chris also served as an intelligence liaison to two secretaries of state and their deputies on worldwide security issues. In 2011, he was awarded the U.S. Department of State's Superior Honor Award for outstanding support to the secretary and her senior staff. Chris, thank you very much for participating in our Carnegie Tsinghua Global Dialogue, and thank you for participating with in our podcast. At the dialogue, there was a lot of discussion about the Chinese proposal to put forward and to try to construct a new type of major country relations. And just 2 weeks ago, the new National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, in her speech, said that the U.S. is interested in operationalizing the new type of major country relations. There is some fear in the United States, however, that this is simply an attempt by China to gain respect and to get the United States to concede to China's core interests, but that the Chinese side doesn't necessarily have any interest in building any content for this new framework. I'm interested to know your views on what you see is behind the Chinese proposal, and is there a way that our two countries can use this to actually build a more positive and constructive relationship?
Thank you, Paul, and thanks for the opportunity to do this and to participate in the forum. It was really fascinating. On the issue of the new style of major country relations, I think it's not just an empty slogan. The Chinese clearly thought about it very clearly before they proposed it. I do think that we've entered into the classic cycle of the Chinese seeking to offer a framework for the relationship, or a catchphrase, as it was discussed during our discussions today, before we can get on to substance. So I think National Security Advisor Rice's formulation was very powerful, actually, to acknowledge the language, but also to put the emphasis on operationalizing. And I think that has to be the U.S. priority going forward, to ensure that there is content to this this new concept. In terms of how we might be able to build it, I think we have to understand the broad framework that it's designed to convey, first and foremost, which is Xi Jinping's message when he visited the United States as vice president, which is we have to find a way of avoiding repeating history between a rising power and an established power meeting on the world stage. And let's face it, the track record's not very good on that front, but I think that there's a determination on the part of both leaderships to try to make it work.
I agree with you. I think the use of the word operational was very important, and I hope that our Chinese friends understand that my own sense is if we're not able to operationalize this, I don't think the United States would be interested in it. And there's no interest in a new bumper sticker. There's no interest in simply a new definition for the relationship. And so I think you raised some very good points. Recent actions like the Air Defense Identification Zone have raised questions about China's priority in regard to its regional diplomacy. It's not clear whether China recognizes that these assertive actions with regard to the East China Sea and also within the South China Sea can cause diplomatic problems and anxiety in the region. However, at the first ever work forum on peripheral diplomacy on October 24th, in Beijing, President Xi Jinping outlined a new strategic approach to China's neighbors. What did you see as the significance of this speech? And what do you think China sees itself, what role do you think China sees itself playing in the Asia Pacific?
I think the meeting with President Xi's speech was very, very significant. My understanding is there's only been a very small number of these during the whole course of the PRC regime, so that's very significant in and of itself. I think we've seen with President Xi several times since he's been in office, there's a sort of approach that's like this, which is to revisit old models but with new content, and to sort of telegraph inside the party machinery especially that he's reaching back into that sort of previous example but then advancing the sort of content with his own philosophy. I think what was very striking about what he came out with in the speech, the little bit we're able to know, of course, is this idea that China effectively acknowledges that for the last several years, they've banned use soccer terminology, scoring own goals on themselves with regard to their responses in the region and how they're perceived in the region. And Xi's message was basically that that's going to end. In terms of the air defense identification zone, it certainly seems to be not in line with this broader message. And I think that's something we need to dig into as observers of Chinese foreign policy is, was the East China Sea and was the relationship with Japan actually excluded from that broad, you know, sort of concept that he was discussing? But I also think it, you have to understand the zone not only in the sort of nature of the current dust-up in Sino-Japanese relations, but in the broader context of how the regime is looking at its external security environment post the rollout of the U.S. rebalance. My own sense is that due to the leadership transition in 2012, the Bolshevik affair, these other things, the leadership really didn't sit down and do a fundamental assessment on what the rebalance means for their assessment of their external security environment. My sense is that now the new leadership has settled in, they're starting to look at these issues, and I think something like the ADIZ puts into a very new context Xi Jinping's statement since he's come to power about the PLA's sort of need to be able to fight and win wars, for example. These sort of statements, if you look at the defense white paper that came out, they talked about the period of strategic opportunity that China always talks about running through 2020. It still exists, but they also say in there that it is under unprecedented stress. And implied in that is that the U.S. rebalance is the source of that stress. So in other words, my sense is that the new leadership team is coming in with an assessment. They don't want conflict. They don't want war, certainly, with their regional neighbors. But they see the potential for conflict between now and 2020 is potentially higher than it has been up until now. And they want the PLA and the whole system to be prepared for that fact.
You talk about the U.S. strategic rebalancing. It has been called into question in recent months, accused of being unsustainable given U.S. budgetary pressures, instability in the Middle East, and of course President Obama missed the APEC and East Asia summit just recently. How will this affect the United States' ability to carry out the rebalancing strategy, and how does this change the view from China with regard to America's policy?
I think in terms of the sustainability of the rebalance, I mean, this is the fundamental question for the second half of the second Obama administration and how they're going to manage that process going forward. I think what the administration deserves very high marks for in that process is very strong speeches and commentary at a very high level. Deputy Secretary Carter made a very important speech. Of course, Mr. Donilon gave a speech at the Asia Society before he left office. So much, much discussion of this is real, it's sustainable, we're going to keep doing this, and that's the direction. I actually think, though, now the challenge for the U.S. in implementing this strategy is stop talking about it and just do it. You know, follow the Nike philosophy, just do it. Get about implementing it. And I think so many areas where we are going to focus our energies on implementing actually have to be done very quietly, very subtly behind the scenes. I'm also very encouraged by the administration's clear decision that they had to rebalance the rebalance and have a much stronger economic and trade component. And I think we're seeing that very clearly, and the administration deserves high marks for that. In terms of the pressures and so on, I think it was best put to me when I was visiting Singapore as the government was shutting down and the president was canceling his trip and so on. It was not that the president was not at these meetings. As we heard today from Prime Minister Rudd, everyone has domestic politics. As it was put to me, the message was what it telegraphs about our dysfunction at home and what that dysfunction at home telegraphs about the sustainability of our commitment in the region. So I think that's an issue we have to focus on and address. And I'm glad that the president is going to make an out-of-cycle trip in April to sort of address some of these things. The other piece I think we have to address is what's next? What's next in the rebalance? You know, everything that's been announced was announced when it was rolled out. You know, a first administration creates the strategic, you know, justification and thinking. The second administration is supposed to be about implementation. And I haven't seen much in the way of implementation beyond what we saw early on. So I'm very keen to see what the next wave of this will be.
I want to move outside of the Asia Pacific in terms of looking at China's evolving foreign policy and ask you whether you see changes in China's foreign policy under this new leadership outside of the region, more internationally. Or do you expect to see changes? Will China begin to play a more active role, given that there is a need for China to shape the international environment for its own domestic development? And where would we expect to see these changes take place, and what should we be looking for?
That's a great question, Paul. Thank you. I think that we are beginning to see a very different flavor out of the new administration's foreign policy, and I think it has several components. The first is that you don't see them talking as much about China being sort of a developing or you know, backward nation. They still use it, of course, in the official formulations, but there's less focus on it. I'm very struck with the resurgence of the term, great power diplomacy, right? Da Guo Wai Zhang is in a lot more central publications and these sort of things. And it's interesting because there's an antecedent for that, which was Jiang Zemin came up with this formulation in the late 1990s into the early 2000s. But what's striking is that at that time, the way they phrased it, it was clearly taking into account U.S. hyperpower. In other words, China would engage in great power diplomacy to the degree they were able under that umbrella of U.S. hyperpower. Now, I think the current version that we're seeing coming out of the regime says, no, China's an equal or a near peer with the United States. And that has totally different connotations. There's a reason why only the United States gets new style major country relations in terms of the formulation. State Councilor Yang was very clear in that in his article that he wrote earlier this year. So I think that in terms of the big picture of how they're going to behave, it's going to be more active, certainly. There's an approach that stresses we will be a great power. We already are one. We need to start acting like one. We want to do that, however, in concert with the United States, having stable, healthy relations with the United States and with our regional neighbors. If, however, the United States doesn't meet us halfway and kind of understand that philosophy, we're going to do what we have to do. And I think we saw some examples of that prior to Sunnylands, where Xi appeared to be attempting almost to get the United States' attention with the visit to Russia and some of these other things. In terms of where we should look, I think people have been far too dismissive of their interest in playing some kind of a role in the Middle East. You know, when Xi hosted the Palestinian president and also the Israeli prime minister, there was a lot of laughing, basically. You know, China can't play a role. I happened to be in the Middle East when that happened. They were very dismissive. But I think they missed the message, which was that as a global power, we need to be playing in this region. And of course, there's the energy and everything else that they have to care about. But there's a political aspect here, and they're starting to play a role in that region. And I think that's one indicator of where we're going.
Of course, the United States, the administration has been saying for some time that it hopes China can begin to play a more constructive role, a more active role on the global stage. However, if and when China does, it is not clear that it'll always be on an American agenda and that they will have the same interests or prefer to use the same approach. Where do you see the biggest challenges internationally with a more active Chinese foreign policy? And where might we see the greatest opportunities for cooperation?
I think in terms of challenges, we're going to continue to see the challenges where we've seen them already, which are in a lot of these developing countries where there's a chase for resources. China obviously has been trying to work on its reputational issues in these countries. They understand that it's a net negative. You know, it's very difficult for the Chinese Communist Party to be perceived as a neo-colonialist power in Africa and these sort of issues. So I think we need to watch to see how they manage that dynamic in terms of the challenges, and I think going to continue to face those. It is definitely true that every time they show up in a new area, there was just some articles recently about their presence in Eastern Europe, for example, and how that's changing the dynamic there. It only seems to have a negative connotation. So how China is able to shed this perception that they're a neo-mercantilist power, basically, I think is going to be a real challenge for them. In terms of opportunities, I think it's how we manage the development of the content of the new type of major country relations. And that's going to be these global issues, humanitarian disaster relief, climate change issues, all these sort of global challenges, even cybersecurity in some of these areas that are more sensitive in our bilateral relationship. There's a global pathway, if you will, to be able to work constructively with the Chinese. And I think we shouldn't shy away from looking for opportunities in the region to work together. My own feeling is that it would be quite significant if we found a way to work together in Myanmar, for example. This is an area where it's perceived to be, you know, zero-sum conflict between China and the United States. What a powerful message it would be to the region in terms of our relationship and the constructive nature of it if we could find a way to work together there.
Well, great. Thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us today on the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. And thank you as well for participating in the Carnegie Tsinghua Global Dialogue. That's it
for this edition of Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. If you'd like to listen to previous episodes of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast, including a discussion with former National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley on the new type of great power relations, you can find those along with a summary of each interview on the Carnegie Tsinghua website, www.carnegiechinghua.org. I encourage you to explore our site and to see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.